This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Climate Crisis Radio, Radio EcoShock. Professor Michael Mann on his new book, The Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet. We prioritize truth versus doomism. From Australia, paleoclimatologist and deep time event investigator, Dr. Andrew Glickson speaks frankly about our situation and the feedback effects governments and the media either don't know or will not tell you. Climate truth, it turns out, is difficult, but not impossible.
Radio EcoShock.
A leading voice in climate science calls us to fight off the powers of fossil fuels that profit from destruction of our climate and biosphere. Professor Michael Mann has just released his book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet. Thrust into the spotlight with the so-called hockey stick graph, showing global warming spiraling out of control, Michael Mann waged his own battle against climate deniers. But all the time he continued world-level scientific research and publishing. Dr. Mann is Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State and Director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. From the great state of Pennsylvania, Michael Mann, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
What historic times. By the time of this broadcast, we trust a new president of the United States will no longer deny the reality of climate change. Michael, what does a Democratic sweep of Congress and the presidency mean for the reinstatement of American climate science as a public purpose?
Yeah, well, it means a lot. We have now gotten rid of a president who not only denied that climate change is real, but in fact did everything within his power to sabotage efforts to actually act on climate. And he was enabled by a Senate, a Republican Senate, that furthered his agenda and blocked any effort for, say, a congressional climate bill to be passed. So now we've got a president who campaigned on this issue and has a mandate to use broad executive powers to ensure that we do everything we can from the executive branch side of things, institute policies, diplomacy, re-enter the Paris Agreement, and use the various agencies to advance climate policy when it comes to funding for renewable energy, when it comes to carbon-friendly agricultural policies, when it comes to the Treasury and requiring companies to disclose climate risk. So there are a whole bunch of things that the executive, the chief executive, you know, Joe Biden, can do. But now he's going to have a Senate, which is narrowly in Democratic hands. It looks like it will be a 50-50 split, with the Democrat Chuck Schumer now becoming the majority leader of the Senate. That means a climate bill can actually make it to the Senate floor. Mitch McConnell prevented any sort of climate legislation from even getting a vote in the Senate. It was dead on arrival. Now we have, you know, Senate that's in Democratic hands. We will get a vote on a climate bill or set of bills. There will be obviously support from Democrats. I think there will be a handful of moderate Republicans who will join with Democrats to actually pass meaningful climate legislation in this next term. So, you know, there are reasons to be cautiously optimistic that we're turning the corner, but not a moment too late. We're already seeing, of course, the devastating impacts that climate inaction has wrought thus far.
Well, yes, we talk about America's military allies, but we also had climate allies, and it's going to be a huge relief for the people in Europe and really the people around the world to think that America could again enter a leadership role in the international arena.
Yeah, no question. I think that's probably the most important development, that the United States will once again engage with the world community, will lead on this issue, which we did back in the days of Barack Obama. He faced an intransigent Republican Congress, but he used his executive authority to act on climate domestically. That allowed him to come to the table with other world leaders in good faith and say, look, we're doing what we can. We want to help lead in international efforts to rein in carbon emissions. The bilateral agreement with China and the U.S. that laid sort of the groundwork for the Paris Agreement. And so that's critical. We have a president who will lead on this issue. He's appointed John Kerry, who has a tremendous legacy when it comes to, you know, his role in the Senate as a senator and co-sponsoring climate legislation, which ultimately failed because there wasn't Republican support for it. But he spearheaded climate legislation. He led the diplomatic efforts to establish both that bilateral agreement between China and the U.S. under the Obama administration, and he played a major role in negotiating the Paris Agreement. And so he has impressive diplomatic bona fides. He's respected by the world community, and he will be leading the international effort for the Biden administration as their new envoy, their special envoy on climate. And moreover, he will sit on the National Security Council, which is an important development as well, that reflects a recognition that climate now has to constitute a major consideration as we consider issues of conflict and security.
Well, yes, pretty shortly we're going to be talking about your new book, The New Climate War. But first, I wanted to mention that in September, I interviewed Dr. Kevin Trenberth, and he left a key position at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research because the funding was slashed under Trump. Last week, we spoke with Dr. Ben Santer, who wrote an op-ed in Scientific American. He's one of the most cited climate scientists, but he was defunded at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I can only guess at the number of good scientists who have left or been discouraged. Can America rebuild its leadership role in climate science?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. Both of those folks are good friends of mine and deeply respected climate scientists. And I think Kevin was sort of ready to transition. He was at that point in his career, and he went back to New Zealand where he's from. He's still doing well. In fact, we're collaborating on an article right now. And Ben Santer remains a leading figure in climate science. And, you know, he will find a good position, and he will still remain sort of one of the leading scientists in the field. But there was quite a bit of damage done, as you know. A war of attrition, the efforts by the Trump administration to basically, in essence, deny financial funding to various scientific institutions, government institutions that do climate research, or to reassign his henchmen sort of in the various agencies, reassign scientists who had been working on climate issues to other areas. We couldn't have withstood another 4 years of Trump, and I was very clear about that before this last election when it comes, for example, to our scientific contributions, the scientific contributions of the American climate science community to this critical issue. We couldn't have afforded another 4 years of Trump, but I think we did survive this assault in large part because fairly early on, the administration recognized that picking a fight with the scientific community wasn't a smart path forward for them. And so they didn't do as much damage as they might have done. They could have done a lot more damage. Instead, they sort of, as I alluded to, were engaged more in a war of attrition, sort of just denying resources to scientists, reassigning scientists. But those scientists are still working. And now under the Biden administration, as we restore rightful funding to the various science agencies in the country that work on issues related to climate, I think we will regain that sort of lost foothold when it comes to our furthering of science, climate science here in the United States, but moreover, when it comes to dealing with the climate crisis itself.
Michael Mann, what fired you up to write your new book, and why did you frame the climate crisis as a war?
Well, the title of my previous book was The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and it's about, you know, a war not of our choosing. The, you know, scientific community, climate scientists have found themselves under attack for decades now by fossil fuel companies, the various front groups and attack dogs that they have funded in their effort to discredit the science of climate change, to confuse the public and policymakers about the reality and threat of climate change. And so we have been in this war with powerful vested interests looking to discredit the science, to intimidate scientists, to block any effort to solve this problem, to get off the burning of fossil fuels. Now, the new climate war refers to the fact that what we're seeing now, as it simply becomes impossible for talking heads to deny that climate change is real, because we're all seeing the impacts of it play out in real time with our own two eyes, on our television screens and our newspaper headlines. It's no longer credible to deny that climate change is happening. And so what the forces of inaction, and I call them the inactivists in this book, and that is to say fossil fuel interests and those promoting those interests, what they've done instead is turn to a whole new array of tactics that are still intended to prevent us from weaning ourselves off fossil fuels, from transitioning away from fossil fuels. Every year we remain addicted to fossil fuels is another year where the fossil fuel industry makes billions and billions of dollars of profits. And so what they're doing now is engaging in other tactics intended to at least delay this transition by dividing the climate advocate community, getting scientists fighting with each other over tactics. It's a divide and conquer approach. Deflecting attention from the need for systemic solutions, for policy solutions, to individual behavior, as if it's just about each of us behaving better, changing our diets, not traveling as much or flying, deflecting attention away from the needed systemic solutions. And that plays in fact, to division. If you can get people arguing with each other over their lifestyle choices, that's a great way to divide the community. And that's something that they're doing. Another front in the new climate war is the sort of promotion of doomism, despair. And ironically, many, you know, environmental progressives fall victim to this feeling that it's too late to do anything, that we've already locked in civilization ending climate change and there's nothing we can do about it. And to the extent that these bad actors can sort of foment this feeling of doom and gloom, it potentially leads, you know, climate advocates down that same path of inaction as outright denial of the problem. And so we have to be aware that these tactics are being waged right now. They're very effective. In many ways, they're more insidious because they're intended to sort of weaponize, to some extent, people of goodwill and good intentions, to weaponize them into fighting with each other, falling into despair, not demanding action on the part of our policymakers. And so I felt, you know, in writing this book that I wanted to make people understand that, look, this war that we wish we didn't have to fight, but, you know, it's not our choice. There is a war being waged by the fossil fuel industry and their advocates. That war isn't over. It's just that the tactics are changing. We need to recognize that because we are so close to the tipping point, not the bad tipping point that we worry about, climate tipping points, and there are some out there, and we do have to worry about that. That's part of why this is so urgent. But there are the good tipping points, the tipping point in public consciousness when it comes to addressing this crisis, and I think we're very close to that.
It could come in a wave. We hope that that wave will come. But meanwhile, as you say, there has been almost an arms race of pessimism, even within the climate movement. A few people sold their possessions and said tearful goodbyes to one another. They were talking about extinction. And yet, here we are. So what are some of the climate fears we can do without, at least for now?
Well, you know, runaway warming. The science just doesn't support that. It's this idea that's been out there, and it's not grounded in good science. There are a few articles that are out there that promote this, but it isn't at all the mainstream scientific understanding. The idea that, you know, the Arctic will release massive amounts of methane that have been trapped in the permafrost, and that will lead to runaway warming. There's just no evidence for that. There is evidence for these so-called carbon cycle feedbacks, which is to say we warm up the planet, we do release some of that frozen methane, and it amplifies the effect. It's what we call a positive feedback. It's a bad thing. It might sound good, but it's bad. It amplifies the warming, and that's real. But the dominant cause of the warming is going to be the continued burning of fossil fuels if we continue down the road that we're on. And so we have to recognize that the only, in a sense, the greatest thing, to quote FDR, the greatest thing to fear is fear itself. The doomism could easily lead us down a path of despair and inaction that prevents us from confronting the problem at its source, which is the burning of fossil fuels. And there's a little bit of scientific good news here over the last decade or so. As the experiments that we run have become more realistic, one thing that's emerged is that if you stop burning carbon, if you stop emitting carbon into the atmosphere, then the oceans in particular naturally start to draw down that carbon. The Earth pulls some of that carbon out of the atmosphere, and those carbon dioxide levels actually start to drop a bit. Now, that sort of counterbalances what we call the delayed warming, which is that once you put those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and you start to warm the planet, there's just a certain amount of thermal inertia, as we call it. The oceans are sluggish. They continue to warm for decades in response to the CO2 we've already put out there. So that would tend to cause additional warming in the future, but the drawdown would actually counteract that. And the two nearly balance out, and the almost magical result is that when we stop burning carbon, global surface temperatures stabilize very quickly within a matter of a few years. And that means that our actions now have a direct and immediate impact on this problem, and that's very enabling.
That is something surprising we've just learned really this year. I have an interview coming up with Andrew McDougall in Nova Scotia, the lead author of a paper published in June 2020 about that finding, that actually it could cool down a bit if we could just stop. And we learned in the pandemic we can slow down infection by staying home for a while. Many of us had to cut our consumption, our shopping, our travel. If we really have a climate emergency, what can we learn from the pandemic responses, Michael Mann?
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question. It's one of the questions I focus on in the last chapter of the new climate war. You know, what lessons can we take away from the pandemic? There's so many of them. We could spend an hour, my friend, just talking about what those lessons are. There are all sorts of lessons about fragility and sustainability writ large, and, you know, how fragile our existence on this planet really is. Society can be turned upside down. Civilization can be turned upside down by a microscopic organism. And so I think there's some larger questions that it raises about, you know, how we can live sustainably on a planet, you know, with finite resources, food and water and space, how to live more sustainably on this planet. That's an important conversation that I hope will be ongoing for a number of years. But there are some more immediate lessons, as you allude to, about sort of how we tackle the climate crisis. The good news is, as you say, look, you know, if we act, in this case, the lockdown and the social distancing weren't really voluntary actions. We were forced to do that by the pandemic, and we saw that that did have an immediate impact. Carbon emissions are going to be down about 7% this year. That's the good news, right? We're actually sort of coming down the ramp now, as we need to do. The bad news is we've got to do that, you know, 7% roughly every year, 7% upon 7%, and then 7% more, and 7% more the year after that for 10 years if we're going to bring carbon emissions down fast enough to avert catastrophic warming of the planet, more than 1.5 degrees Celsius or roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming. To do that, behavioral change alone simply isn't going to be enough. We are going to need to decarbonize civilization. We're going to need to decarbonize all the sectors of the modern economy. And that requires serious systemic change, not just behavioral change. But we can do it. And, you know, a number of things have come together. And one of them, really just today, as we speak, it's becoming clear that Democrats will likely control the U.S. Senate, which means we'll see a climate bill or set of bills on the Senate floor now. And we might actually see them pass Congress and get signed by a President Biden. So we're in a position to act. The political winds have sort of aligned in a favorable way. And we've learned some important lessons as well. And then finally, and I would be remiss in not mentioning the youth climate movement, Greta Thunberg and the other youth climate activists around the world who have raised sort of global attention on this issue and have recentered this issue where it belongs. This isn't just about science and policy and politics. It's about ethics, intergenerational ethics, our obligation not to degrade this planet for future generations. So I think all of these strands have come together now in a favorable way. They've aligned in a way that really places us at the precipice now of really acting meaningfully on this crisis before it's too late. And so I'm cautiously optimistic as we go into 2021 that we'll look back at 2020, as awful as it was, as sort of the turning point when it came to climate action.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is famous American climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann. We're talking about his new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet. Now, Michael, the governments of the world, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and plenty of climate models assume large amounts of carbon will be recaptured from the atmosphere and stored underground out of the loop. Is that happening, and can it happen fast enough to really avoid the climate tragedy?
It's sort of a muddled conversation. I think the truth is somewhere in between. You know, I think that some of the scenarios that have been put forward, for example, in the IPCC assessments, are really, you know, place too much emphasis on as yet non-existent technology, technology that in principle could be used, but there's no evidence yet that can be scaled up quickly enough to make a meaningful dent in our carbon emissions. At the edges, it could make a real difference. And so, you know, there may be some role for artificial carbon uptake. You know, we said the oceans are going to be continue to take some of the carbon out of the atmosphere. They're working on our behalf. Forests do that. The biosphere does that. Reforestation and afforestation can, and stopping deforestation certainly can help do that, can help the Earth better sort of naturally sequester carbon. But that mostly acts at the margins. Unless we tackle this problem at its source, which is the ongoing spigot of carbon dioxide coming out of our burning of fossil fuels for energy and transportation and industry and everything else, unless we tackle this problem at its source, artificial and natural carbon uptake efforts are almost like deck chairs on the Titanic, the metaphorical deck chairs on the Titanic. So we shouldn't allow them to serve as a distraction for the true task at hand, which is stopping the burning of fossil fuels. But some of these technologies may help at the margins, may help us, you know, keep CO2 levels below catastrophic levels. What we can't allow them to be is a crutch for not taking the more essential action of stopping the burning of fossil fuels.
Reading your book, I came to wonder, what is the sunrise movement, and is it helping or hurting the cause of climate action?
Well, like any movement, you know, I think the sunrise movement, I see it as sort of part of this larger movement, the youth climate movement, to raise awareness about the climate crisis, and they've done a real service. And so the sunrise movement sort of reflects a younger demographic, a sort of a youthful sector of our population, just like the youth climate movement writ large. And I think it's been really important in sort of shifting the whole conversation. That having been said, like any organization, at times, you know, they've taken positions that I'm not in full agreement with. And I talk about this in the book at some length. For example, the importance of using market mechanisms as one of the lever arms in tackling the climate crisis, putting a price on carbon, subsidies for renewable energy. Market mechanisms are one of the tools in the toolbox, and we need to use every tool that's available to us to tackle this crisis. So I think simply taking some of those tools off the table, as the Sunrise Movement is sort of alluded to at times, I don't agree with that particular position. But look, you know, there's room for a healthy sort of debate about the specifics, the policy specifics, when it comes to tackling this problem. On the larger matter that's relevant here, the need to act immediately and to recognize that we do have a crisis, you know, we're all, you know, the Sunrise Movement and I and all of my other colleagues who have been advocating for climate action, we're on the same basic page. And so this is really a debate about some of the specifics of climate policy. And, you know, there's room for that debate. That's the debate we should be having.
Now, I think the public is going to take years to get out of the shell shock from this onslaught of the coronavirus pandemic. Economies are battered. Countless families are grieving. How can we, at the same time, demand wrenching changes when people just want to get back to good old normal?
Yeah, it's great. Well, that's why, you know, it's called the great, there's a term that people are using, the great realignment or something. Let's do both at the same time, right? Let's rebuild our infrastructure and our economy in a clean, sensible way, in a way that embraces clean energy, renewable energy. We can do both. You know, it's a false choice that is sometimes set up by the inactivists, the forces of inaction, who would like you to think that we have to make a choice between sort of saving our environment and growing our economy. We can do both at the same time. And, you know, clean energy, the clean energy transition, the sorts of policies that Biden and the Democrats are talking about now, we'll do both of those things. It'll get us going again, and it'll rebuild our infrastructure in a much better way, in a clean, green, and sort of in a way that just feels right. Look, the age of fossil fuels has come to an end. It's time to move on. And this is really an opportunity to accelerate that transition.
The coming years are going to be kind of hard for growing food. We're going to have big storms and fires, unstable weather, more record heat waves. But I'm wondering, you've used the analogy of a war. When America has been attacked, or when any country's been attacked, the people tend to work together in a common cause, and perhaps these extreme events will galvanize us to work fast enough to do more.
I think that's exactly right. One of my sci-fi author heroes, Kim Stanley Robinson, has written a wonderful book that people should check out, Ministry for the Future. And what I like so much about it, it doesn't sugarcoat it. It recognizes what you just said. We're going to have some tough times ahead. Dangerous climate change has already arrived. Dangerous impacts have already arrived. There's no way to avoid them. But there is still time to make the changes that ensure that we do see a much brighter future. And there are too many dystopian sort of narratives that we see in sci-fi and cli-fi, as it's called, of a world, a degraded world resulting from climate inaction. But there are also the possibilities of utopias. We've sort of alluded to that, building back clean and green, and rethinking some basic questions about what sort of world we want to have, basic questions about sustainability. And Kim Stanley Robinson sort of paints a credible future path where we do go through some upheaval. We have to deal with some of the devastating impacts of climate change, but we do come out on the other side in a pretty good-looking place. And so I think that future is possible, but it demands immediate action, and I think we're going to see that action.
All right, so I'm picturing people getting your new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back the Planet, and they tuck it under their arms, and they go out and they do something with it. And how can people use your new book?
Well, you know, they could use it as biofuel. No, I'm just kidding. Joke. You know, I'm hoping that the book, you know, engages people. It awakens there are so many good folks who are on the right side of this issue, who want to do the right thing, who have been led astray by the inactivists, by the forces of inaction. And I want them to recognize some of the tactics that are being used, in particular the sort of purveying of doom and gloom that is intended to dispirit them and inactivate them. So I want them to be engaged. I want them to recognize that they're being played by some of the bad actors right now in a way that's a bit more subtle. And it's important to recognize and combat those tactics that are being used today in the new climate war. But let's not be too distracted. We have to combat those tactics, but we have to stay focused on the prize, which is moving forward and acting, doing everything we can from an individual standpoint, but from a collective standpoint as well. And so I hope that people read this book and come away empowered to act when it comes to the greatest challenge we face as a civilization, the climate crisis.
You have been listening to the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State, Dr. Michael Mann. And you can find out more about his new book and his latest work at michaelmann.net. I will also put links for you to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael Mann, I thank you so much for your tireless battle to help the public understand.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I appreciate your efforts to get the word out there.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. On a personal note, while I admire 98% of Michael's work, I do not agree we can continue to grow the economy and save the climate. In our current time and the foreseeable decade, any growth of national or gross domestic product will create more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That's just the way it works. I think we have to shrink the consumer economy even further than during the pandemic, simplify life, and reorder social rewards towards those who create social welfare for all.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A candle lights the darkness, then burns out. Is that the fate of the human species? As the pandemic rages, where are we now in the climate crisis? Dr. Andrew Glickson is an earth and paleoclimate scientist with the Climate Science Institute at Australian National University. His latest book from Springer Press is The Event Horizon, Homo Prometheus and the Climate Catastrophe. From Canberra, Australia, Andrew Glickson, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you very much, Alex. It's good to hear you.
These are horrible times. For most people in the Northern Hemisphere, this pandemic, it feels like a long jail sentence with few visitors allowed. How are you holding up, Andrew?
Yes, the pandemic is a horrible, horrible thing for about hundreds of thousands, even millions of people. In perspective, pandemics have always occurred in human history, especially the history of civilization. It's only that, well, perhaps psychologically, we're not prepared for it. But three of my grandparents have died in the great flu epidemic. So it's in part a question of memory, collective memory. Yes, the pandemic is awful. Australia is doing particularly well. Yes, it's a very well-organized society. I am, well, at my stage of life, I suppose I'm somewhat vulnerable with my diabetes. But other than that, so far, I'm well. Thank you for asking.
Well, let's see if we can escape into deep time, and you're a specialist in chronicling that. When were the fastest rates of global warming that scientists can find, and do any compare to our current rate of heating the world?
None compares to what's happening now. They're all the ones which occur at the end of the ice ages. They are at least an order of magnitude slower, lesser than what's happening now. Of course, as you know, what's happening now is happening within one generation.
Well, during the last few million years, changes in the Earth's orbit, we know the way we orbit around the sun triggered a back and forth of ice ages and warm periods. And by that measure, I've recently read, Earth should have returned to cooling and to more glaciers somewhere around 5,000 years ago when the Egyptians were building pyramids. Is there new science to explain why that did not happen?
Right through the period of the Holocene, which is from about 10,000 years ago to the present, there have been intermittent cooling, but nothing major, but the sign of it has been approaching or moving towards the next ice age. This shows very well in the charts. When you look at the charts from the Holocene peak at about 9,000 and 8,000, until the Industrial Revolution, there are a lot of ups and downs, but on average, there has been a gradual cooling by somewhat less than 1 degree. But, of course, everything has changed. During the Holocene, civilization already started to release carbon dioxide and methane from agriculture and burning of the forests. So this cooling was mitigated by human activity, but not enough to conceal this otherwise overall cooling trajectory.
And as you develop this big picture for humanity, you spend a chapter in your new book on human origins. What was our birth environment like? What are we built for?
All right, these were the ice ages, the glacial, interglacial ages, and the human existence was precarious. The conditions, there were only relatively small human clans. Many of them were in the subtropics in Africa, where they were shielded from the ice ages or the worst of the ice ages. Humans had to migrate due to changes in the climate and extreme weather events from Africa to part of Asia and eventually Europe. Human existence was precarious right through the glacial interglacial period, at least until they adopted or mastered fire. Fire allowed humans to survive and even expand over large parts of the world.
Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I know in other writings you have developed how fire may have helped us with our intelligence, or at least with our minds. Could you just give us a brief shot at that one?
Yeah, thank you. It's partly based on my own life experience around campfires in conducting geological service in Central and Western Australia. Sitting around the fire for hours, many hours, just about every night, for many weeks and many months, has a profound effect on the mindset. And I just inferred from that, I mean, even though I've spent, whatever I've spent, maybe 30 years or so around campfires, I infer that the humans who spent most or all of their lives around campfires, that they were profoundly affected by watching the flames. Flames are alive. They dance, they crackle when humans watch them for hours and hours, every night, well, almost every night. They get affected, and it would trigger and enhance human imagination. It did to me. I started writing poetry around campfires. So I made some inferences. Of course, these things cannot be proven in a formula or even in a direct experiment. Very difficult. But I had this thought, and this goes further from people who regarded fire as a basis for the appearance of modern humans, who became taller, could run faster. They were able to perspire once the fur has been shed, and they were able to cook meat. Cooking meat made a difference. They started to increase the nutrition from proteins and so on.
We know right as we speak that Greenland is melting a lot. I mean, fresh water is just pouring right off of Greenland. You have written about something called a stadial event. Why are you raising those concerns now? What is a stadial event, and why now?
The observation of stadial events is relatively recent, because it came up from the study of the oceans and from satellites. Initially, south of Greenland, where a large blob of cold water was identified by a number of oceanographers, Ramsholt is from the Potsdam Institute, was the first one who published it, or maybe not the first one, but he wrote a paper in 2015, which is the title is Exceptional Cooling, Exceptional Expansion of Cooling Areas South of Greenland, in North Atlantic. Well, it could be regarded just as accidental or insignificant, but it has been growing. Ocean regions have been going around Antarctica. Again, the flow of ice melt water is clearly the major factor. So my approach didn't start from this modern observation. It started more from paleoclimate. When you look at the glacial interglacial periods, every time when temperatures reach the peak, and that's even in the early Holocene, about, 8,000 years ago, and before then, between 11 and 12,000 years ago, every time temperatures have reached the peak, almost every time without any variation, without any exception, I should say, there was abrupt cooling. And sometimes the cooling was occurred over very short periods. The best-known one is called the Younger Dryas, when much of the Earth, but particularly the Northern Hemisphere, cooled for longer than 1,000 years. And it cooled extremely abruptly, and the cooling in the Northern Hemisphere was several degrees. There was also some cooling in the Southern Hemisphere. And this is what's referred to as a stadial, abrupt cooling event for various periods. The most recent one was 8,200 years ago in the Laurentian, closer to your part of the world, when melting of the Laurentian ice sheet resulted in a major flow of ice melt water into North America, forming a large lake called Lake Agassiz. This is very well documented in the paleoclimate record and charts.
So this might be, though, more of a regional event than a global event. Is that correct? Like it might cool Britain and Europe more than they would have been if this happens.
The Younger Stadial was a global event. not a storm in the southern hemisphere as in the northern hemisphere, but a global event, and for a long time, longer than 1,000 years. The Laurentian a bit less so than there are all the events in the paleoclimatic record. And the thing is, it's basically the law of physics. When the ice melts it, particularly the large ones, Greenland is very large, but Antarctic is huge. When they melt, enough cold water flow into the surrounding oceans to cool at least the upper part of the water column down to a few hundred meters, maybe a kilometer or so, whereas the warm water resulting from global warming at the present time, they occur beneath it, because cold water, as you know, is lighter, less dense. The warm water are salty, so they are more dense.
That's interesting because, you know, with air, we think of warm air as being lighter than cold air, but it's the reverse with water because of the salt factor. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, yes.
I'm also very interested in what's coming up from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They have a synthesis report, the AR6, set to be released in June 2022. Have you heard anything about new developments in that?
Not of the sixth one, but I was a reviewer of one of the earlier ones, and I wrote quite a detailed report. They never replied to my report, and I assume to other ones. You write it, and it disappears into a big black hole. But I have a few things I'd like to convey to you regarding the IPCC. First, there is a principle that no committee has ever written a symphony. You get several hundred scientists, all of them competent scientists, written peer-reviewed papers. The IPCC cites these papers in some detail, and that's very excellent, fantastic. However, when it comes to the summary for policyholders, then there are a small group of people, the leaders, who summarize or rather draw the conclusions out of all this literature. Something happens there. It's a large, very large committee, and the conclusions are based on a lot of data. But the question is, are they the correct conclusions? Well, looking at it now for a number of years, a number of leading climate scientists, the ones who do not belong to the IPCC, but are the great, you can say, pioneers and thinkers and publishers in climate science, have published observations and conclusions which differ markedly from those of the IPCC. The main one, the single most important one, when you look at the plots and trajectories and trends of IPCC projections, they are essentially smooth and linear. Then, if there is mitigation, they slow down and eventually start slowing down or going down. And this was the hope. Unfortunately, I don't think it's a real hope that the curve will go up slowly and then go down slowly again, and that humanity will have time to control the process. Well, unfortunately, it seems from, at least from my paleoclimate science studies, that nature does not behave like this. From certain points of warming, and the same is true for cooling, there are what you call amplifying feedbacks. Amplifying feedbacks, the most obvious one at the moment, at the present time, will be the release of methane. Methane has been in the atmosphere, has tripled. That's a major, major reinforcement or amplifying factor. So these smooth trends, they conceal the amplifying feedbacks, and they certainly don't even mention the studies resulting from the flow of cold ice melt water. So here's the first one. It's almost obvious, but the question is whether the sixth report will dwell on it or not. I don't know. They never even mentioned it in previous reports. They didn't mention amplifying feedbacks. They didn't mention studies. They didn't mention the rate at which the ice sheets are breaking. They already have been breaking for at least 20 years. It's based on studies of people who actually looked at the satellite data and even went to Greenland. They have been breaking very fast, and yet the IPCC has hardly mentioned it. Fires. we know all about fires. You know about fires. I know about fires. They have been, well, the role of fires had been minimized, I'd say. Some of the greatest climate scientists that we had, one of them is Wally Boker, an American scientist, is still alive in Lamont Doherty in Columbia University. He said something which is really a key statement. He says the paleoclimate record shows to us that far from being self-stabilizing, the Earth climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts even to small nudges. Now, here we go. These are the tipping points we're talking about. These are the extreme weather events we are looking at, whether it's the beast from the east going through the Arctic boundary, I should say, or whether it's the warm tropical forms which are also penetrating into the Arctic. You know about the fires in the Arctic, in Greenland and Scandinavia. These have been, to date, I hope they will correct it in the sixth report, either minimized or overlooked by the IPCC.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Earth and paleoclimate scientist Dr. Andrew Glickson from ANU in Australia. And we're talking about humanity's approach to the climate catastrophe. And you talked about leading climate scientists, and obviously the name of James Hansen is going to come up. Now, I know not all scientists agree with his work. For example, I interviewed Dr. Bjorn Stevens from the Max Planck Institute. He says cooling from aerosols is much lower than Hansen suggests, and the IPCC reports they estimate sea level rise much lower than Hansen does. Do you know James Hansen, and how much confidence do you have in his work?
James Hansen, to me, has made the few most important advances in climate and paleoclimate science over the last 30 years. But it's not just him. People quote one name. He is leading up a very large group of climate scientists and paleoclimate scientists, mostly in the United States, but not only. Now, I've read many of his publications, and being myself mostly a paleoclimate scientist, I was impressed by his insights, and actually where his projections have actually turned out to be correct. Yeah, people can say that he has underestimated or overestimated the aerosols, but he himself, in more than one paper, he says that the level at which aerosols affects the terrestrial climate is still to be known in much greater detail. He said it himself. Now, people like to criticize other people at the top. For example, look at the criticism in historical context which Einstein has received. Well, Einstein was a huge brain. He conceived relativity and special relativity the way which no committee would ever do. No committee such as the IPCC would ever arrive at some of the major conclusions which scientists, individual scientists, and sometimes small groups of scientists have reached. Hansen has already in 1980, 1990, perceived the major feature, major hallmarks of what we are looking at now, right now. People who read his papers will see that he has almost written almost in some detail what's happening in the Earth now in terms of warming, in terms of extreme weather events.
So now we come to the point where the IPCC and all governments really have agreed that we need to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in order to get back to a stable climate where we can live. What methods to reduce greenhouse gases in the atmosphere would you favor?
Yes, they agree now that it has to be reduced. But most of the talk is about lower emissions, which of course is essential. It's essential to lower and even cut emissions as much as possible. Fewer scientists talk about carbon dioxide drawdown, and yet the amplifying feedbacks are getting stronger all the time. How do they reply or answer to this issue? Well, only few of them do. There are now quite a bit of literature about CO2 drawdown sequestration. But not all scientists are acquainted with the effect of amplifying feedbacks. And in fact, climate science is very far from uniform. you have those climate scientists who observe present trends, current trends in the atmosphere and the oceans and the land. Then you get the paleoclimate scientists who look at atmospheric and ocean events in the past, in the near past, and the further away. But then you get a very large group of the computer modelers. This is where I have a problem. Computer modeling is, of course, because it's got to do with computer, which is a modern mod con, is something that people see as real science. But modeling is based on assumptions. Assumptions might or might not be correct. And the result, the product of computer modeling, we just talked about it. It's linear, totally unrealistic linear trends going all the way to the end of this century and even 2300. This is something that has, I think, confused the picture more than anything else. And that's a product of computers. They simply fed in the various factors. But what they didn't feed are the amplifying feedbacks, so they only fed it to a limited extent. They ignored the phenomenon of stadials, which was already shown to be at least since, the last 2015, but even before that. I have major problems with computer modeling.
And I noticed, too, a chapter on what you call space lunacy, but scientists depend on observations coming from satellites. Why are you railing about the sort of space madness that's developing now?
Reducing emissions is absolutely essential, but no longer sufficient. So for some billionaires who are not subject to really any democratic system or any electoral system to squander the remaining resources which we have on Earth on these space games is, I think it's criminal. Now, I have studied asteroids and I find the planets and space extremely interesting, I think even exciting. But to spend trillions on that, this is criminal because...
Well, the idea that we're going to escape from a crumbling Earth and just have colonies on Mars is pretty absurd and, as you say, damaging. Now, I want to get in here a quote that I found in your new book from James Hansen, and he said this: "We've reached a point where we have a crisis, an emergency, but people don't know that. There's a big gap between what's understood about global warming by the scientific community and what is known by the public and policymakers." Is that still true, or are people starting to get it?
To me, what James Hansen said is precisely what needs to be said. People now know in principle that there is a phenomenon of climate change, but not all that many realize how immediate, urgent, and serious it is. The ones who realize are the school children, such as Greta Thunberg and her followers, because they seem to have an open mind about it. But by and large, the media, as far as I can see, dominated by vested interests. They have been denying climate change for 20 or 30 years. Now they admit that something is going on, but they will try and minimize it. And of course, as we know, the governments and vested interests and the media are very closely connected.
Well, something we all need to find ways to cope with, sort of the uber knowledge of global warming coming at us like a freight train, and our daily needs to perhaps get in a car and go and get some food with a gas engine. So one of the ways that it seems to me that you're handling this, as you say in your book, is existential philosophy. Now, some of my listeners won't know what that is, but how does that help you cope?
Well, I'm in a position, unfortunate position, that a large, huge part in me doesn't want to scare other people or cloud other people's days. People around me, well, not everybody really wants to know. And I understand it perfectly. People want to live in the present or the near future. So that's one part of me that's a humanist in me, which doesn't want to depress other people, and I don't. The other part is the sense of duty of the scientist to report the evidence, report the facts. Because what are we doing science for if we are reluctant or refuse to report the evidence? I'm not saying that the evidence of which I'm aware is a whole or complete truth. Of course, we all make errors and mistakes. But I think the phenomenon of global climate disruption is now beyond doubt. It's moved well beyond doubt, and the people who have been throwing doubt have been shown to be, in part receiving funds from vested interests. So I'm in that conflict. I do report the evidence, but a large part of me says, well, Andrew, what's the point? And the other part says, well, perhaps the train already left the station and it's too late to do anything about it. Climate scientists are in this bind, but not all of them respond in the same way.
So your new book, The Event Horizon, Homo Prometheus and the Climate Catastrophe, it comes from the textbook publisher Springer. All their titles are pretty expensive. They're designed for professional audiences. Who do you think will benefit from this book? And where else can my listeners go to find some of your public writing?
Yeah, well, there are summaries of my book, and of course, there's an awful lot, there's a mountain of literature on this very issue elsewhere, including in some part of the media. It's a question whether people want to read it, want to listen, and even if they do, whether they are able to do very much about it. I do admire the young, the school children, I do. If there is hope, it's these young children who might bring it about. But I am, of course, at a different stage of my life. And people say that climate scientists and so on are optimists or pessimists or whatever they are. It's inherent in science, and even when you do science for much or most of your life, that you try and go beyond your feelings, your emotions of being optimist or pessimist. I think many of us certainly are, try and look directly at the evidence and draw conclusions from it. As to how it affects our feelings, well, some of us get depressed. Of course I get depressed. But some of us decide, well, we just need to report it so that, at least for the benefit of future generations.
We've been speaking with Dr. Glickson, a climate scientist, geologist, asteroid tracker, deep time specialist. Find links to his new book and some recent articles you can look at for free and more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. It's always great talking with you.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for the interview and for your programs and for the information, evidence which you are disseminating. I hope and I'm sure it will have a very positive effect.
I'm Alex Smith. We are out of time, for this week's show at least. Despite raging disease and crumbling politics, you keep showing up. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.